Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Big intersecting lines of war and politics in Washington this week. The president in and out of Baghdad, Karl Rove out of legal jeopardy, off the grand jury's leash, and back in the thick of political framing. Congress debating Iraq, but staring at November elections. Republicans are betting they can line voters up at the polls once more with a call to stay the course and a cut-and-run attack on the Democrats. Dems struggling to stand tall and critique a war gone badly wrong. Everyone trying to figure out where you stand on the matter, whether the country's heart and mind and votes are still in it. We've got great analysts with us this hour to size up the big stories of the week. Jonathan Alter joins me from New York. He's senior editor and columnist for Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. Jonathan Alter, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Tom.
William McKenzie joins us from deep in the heart of Texas. He's editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News and a longtime Bush watcher. Bill McKenzie, good to have you back with us as well.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Jonathan, and Bill.
Great to have everybody here. Very interesting week. Let's jump straight in. Jonathan Alter, what's your story, big story, top story this week, and why?
Well, I think it's scuffling over Iraq on the floor of Congress. You know, it felt like this was both parties' last chance before everybody goes to the beach to try to frame this issue for the voters for the November midterm elections. And even though they're a ways off, you saw some real, headbutting at the line of scrimmage yesterday that made for, if not high drama, at least intense politics.
Some very high language we heard there in that montage. Representative Charlie Norwood, Republican of Georgia, saying the American people need to know precisely who they are. He said, is it time to stand up? And it is time to stand up and vote. Will it be Al-Qaeda or America? Is it about the war or is it about the politics, Jonathan?
Well, I think it's about both, but, you know, it's a sign. Congressman Norwood's comments are a sign in combination with the clip that you played of Karl Rove that the Republicans are going to go back to the well one more time on this issue that's worked so well for them in the last three elections, and that is making the Democrats the party of pansies and weenies and cut and runners and people who don't want to fight for America. And in this case, explicitly, according to Congressman Norwood, support Al-Qaeda over America. So that's their argument. There's an old expression from Chicago politics, which is the milieu that I come out of. My mother was a politician in Chicago.
Yeah.
And that is, you dance with the one who brung you. And the one who brung the Republicans was trying to stigmatize the Democrats as wimps, and they're going to go with it again this fall.
Politics back in full gear there. Bill McKenzie in Dallas, what's caught your eye this week? What's at the top of your card?
Well, I think Bush had a good week, and that's after, as we know, a long bout of really bad weeks. I mean, first we have the trip to Iraq, which gets everybody by surprise. It looks like we have some kind of government to start dealing with. They now have an interior defense minister. I don't think I'd want to be in those people's shoes. They have a tough road to go, but at least they got those named. There was a USA Today Gallup poll showing that Bush is up 7 points over May, still low. I think it's around 38% in that poll.
Still a good bump.
Still a good bump. And then no matter what you think about Karl Rove, he is cleared. So on those 3 points, Bush had a good week after a long, long dry spell.
Can you feel Karl Rove breathing into the politics of this week again? Is he indeed off the leash already, off the grand jury leash, out from under that shadow in a way that makes him once again number one strategist?
Yeah, I think Jonathan is right. I think, unfortunately, we're going to see this kind of scorched earth strategy for November where they're going to try to paint the Democrats, as Jonathan said, as pansies. And, you know, I think at some point the American public really wearies about that. And maybe I'm wrong on it, but I think at some point, you know, you just people get tired of that. I mean, you look at this Unity 08, I believe it's called, group that's kind of emerging that's trying to find some part of the center. And we see this in different cycles. You know, you even go back to 2000. Bush was the guy running as the person who was going to, yes, unite, not divide us. And you see some rumblings about this in some of the 08 campaigns that are already kind of formulating, McCain and others trying to talk about doing politics differently. So, yeah, Republicans are probably going to do it. I'm not sure that's the best approach.
And you're our conservative voice looking on there. Jack Beatty, what do you see? What's at the top of your dance card this week? What's the top story on the Beatty list?
Well, I think we looked into the moral pit of Guantanamo with the suicide of the three detainees. You know, according to the Pentagon's own figures, this is the government's own figures, 55% of these detainees, these 517, did not commit any hostile acts against the U.S. or coalition forces. Only 8% are al-Qaeda fighters. Only 5% were captured by U.S. troops. Fully 93% were turned in by bounty hunters in Afghanistan and Pakistan and or by Pakistani officials. They were turned in pursuant and following leaflets like this. Get wealth and power beyond your dreams. You can receive millions helping the anti-Taliban forces catch al-Qaeda. This is enough money to take care of your family, your village, your tribe for the rest of your life. There's a man there who was caught for wearing, who's there for wearing an olive drab clothing. There's another man there who was caught for holding a Kalashnikov. Of course, it's a Kalashnikov culture in Afghanistan. This Guantanamo has done more damage to the United States, to our image around the world, perhaps, than almost anything else connected to this war. And, of course, it's been a wholesale trashing of our best traditions.
And yet it is a real tar baby and hard to get away from here. Let's listen to the president in the Rose Garden on Wednesday talking about Guantanamo.
No question Guantanamo sends a signal to some of our friends. It provides an excuse, for example, to say the United States is not upholding the values that they're trying to encourage other countries to adhere to. And my answer to them is that we are a nation of laws and rule of law. These people picked up off the battlefield, and they're very dangerous. And so we have that balance between customary justice, you know, the typical system, and one that will be done in the military courts. And that's what we're waiting for.
There's President Bush on Guantanamo. We'll look at Iraq and Karl Rove. But how about this one, Jonathan Alter? How does the president deal with it? I mean, three suicides, that's not pretty. Polls from around the world show Americans standing in public opinion, even in old allies, falling again. And he himself points and says Guantanamo is part of the reason. And yet, what to do with those hundreds? I think it's 460 in custody there now.
Well, there's no easy answer because, you know, if they're tried in conventional courts or according to, you know, standard military justice, there's not a lot of evidence to hold many of them, as Jack indicated. But then if they're released en masse, the president and his people fear that perhaps one of them will go back and commit an act of terrorism and, you know, that they'll be caught on what they would describe as the wimpy side of the issue. So they're kind of in for a dime, in for a dollar. And I think they get the sense that, they made this bed back in 2001, 2002, and they're going to have to lie in it now. And they don't feel like it will cost them at all politically, that there's just no price to be paid in American politics for being tough on what they consider to be suspected terrorists at Guantanamo.
Bill McKenzie, the president says he wants them to go before military courts. The U.S. courts have some say in that. Is that going to be a solution here?
Well, I kind of tend to think Jonathan is right. I think the Bush administration is kind of stuck on this, and I think they are going to kind of just grind it out with these guys down here. Whether they ever make it to a military court or not, I don't know. But that leads us to really the question, was this a good strategy from the beginning? And I I have to admit, after 4 or 5 years of watching it, I'm probably more Jack Scamp. I just don't think this is consistent with our principles.
So, Jack, how does this get sorted out? It's sitting there. The whole world is watching, as they say. Jonathan Alter says American voters may not swing on this one. And yet George Bush is handling it gingerly there. He's conceding this week in the Rose Garden that it doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good, and it looks worse as you look at it more closely. You know, the Pentagon keeps its list of terrorist groups, the State Department's its list. And according to the, if you compare the two lists, there are 64 people there whom the State Department would admit to the United States because of their connection with groups that the State Department does not deem terrorist, whom the Pentagon is holding. In other words, if they applied for a visa to the State Department, they could get in. For the Defense Department, they're at Guantanamo. You know, this business about why won't they let them go? Well, of course, if they let them go, imagine the stories they're going to tell all over the world. These are stories that could get President Bush and Mr. Rumsfeld and others in this administration before the, or at least hearings could be held or proceedings before the International Criminal Court for the violation of the laws of war.
Three suicides a week ago, and the first deaths at Guantanamo, but these were by no means the first suicide attempts. And I guess you're right. If hundreds of them are out on the street and around the world, that's sort of one for every talk show on the planet. Let's listen to President Bush once again in the Rose Garden saying Iraq is the war on terror.
Iraq is not the only part of this war. It's an essential part. But it's not the only part of the war on terror. And so the decisions I make are all aimed at protecting the American people and understanding the vast stakes involved. If the United States of America leaves before this Iraqi government can defend itself and sustain itself and govern itself, it'll be a major blow in the war on terror.
There's President Bush saying it is a big part of the war on terror. Not the whole thing, but central to it. Democrats struggling a little bit to figure out how to respond. John Kerry with his proposal to get out. That kind of bobbled through this week. Here's Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton speaking at the Progressive Take Back America conference earlier this week in Washington, getting cheered and booed on Iraq.
But I have to just say it. I do not think it is a smart strategy either for the president to continue with his open-ended commitment, which I think does not put enough pressure on the new Iraqi government, nor do I think it is smart strategy to set a date certain. I do not agree that that is in the best interest of our troops or our country.
You hear the Democrats right there, Jonathan Alter, the cheering and the booing. No date certain, Hillary says, and the Democrats not sure how to respond to that. Divided.
Yeah, well, you know, she is going to have to follow John Edwards' course and admit that she made the wrong vote on Iraq before the war. she's just delaying the pain. She's going to have to do it sooner or later. And I don't think she'll ever get nominated. She might, in my view, she might not be, probably won't be nominated anyway, but she certainly won't be unless she admits that she voted wrong on the war initially. I think if she did that, she could more easily convince people of her position that setting a date certain is not the responsible course. But until she admits that she got snookered, as John Edwards and John Kerry have both admitted, she won't go anywhere.
Bill McKenzie, how about it? You're saying earlier that even you may be a little tired of the pansy charge, the cut-and-run charge. On the other hand, what about the date-certain withdrawal position? Are you ready for that?
No, and I don't know what Democrats gain from that. I think the Democrats are in position. The Republicans are on immigration. Republicans in the House are playing to the base on immigration. Some of the folks in the Senate are playing to the base on Iraq. And I'm not sure that the base in the Democratic Party represents the mainstream of America on it, just like I don't think the base in the Republican Party represents necessarily the mainstream of America on immigration. So I think the Democrats have to make up their mind. Are they trying to turn out the base in November and ride on that? Or are they trying to figure out really what is going to have a broader appeal and perhaps more importantly, what really is the best strategy for America? And it's hard for me to see how setting a date certain is a good strategy for America.
But strategy and politics riding so close to one another here and sort of bending each other, let's listen to a little bit of yesterday's back and forth in Congress. Here's House Speaker Dennis Hastert in the debate on the war of Iraq saying, stand firm.
We must stand firm in our commitment to fight terrorism and the evil inflicts throughout the world. We must renew our resolve that the actions of evildoers will not dictate American policy.
So there it is, gauntlet down. No matter what there's been, the $9 billion every week, the 2,500 now dead, all the missteps along the way, we've got to stand firm. And if you don't, you're not against evildoers. Here's Pennsylvania Democratic Congressman John Murthas speaking on the House floor also yesterday, keying off his own experiences as a Vietnam veteran.
1 month after I come out of Vietnam, everything's going to be all right. You know how many people we lost from 1967 till we pulled out? 37,000. Rhetoric does not answer the problem. Only the Iraqis can solve the problem in Iraq. They're fighting with each other and our troops are caught in between. And I say it's time to redeploy and be ready.
Jack Beatty, you're watching Iraq. You saw with all the rest of us the president on his Buck Rogers flight in and out. You listened to a lot of that debate yesterday. What are you seeing here, Jack?
Well, you know, some people, including Ray LaHood, the Republican from Illinois, basically thought that the Republicans were pulling a stunt here. He said as much. And they were. I mean, they wanted the Democrats to have to, come out to vote against this resolution, which says there shall be no arbitrary date by which troops should be removed. But on the other hand, and of course, it was the debate took place under very loaded circumstances. The Democrats were not allowed to admit any amendments. It was just this or nothing. On the other hand, here were the congressmen talking about the main issue before the country for the first time, really, since the war resolution. And we did hear, I guess I listened to maybe 3 or 4 hours of the debate, and I was impressed with the level of it. I mean, the Republicans were short on the facts, but they were long on the logic. And they kept saying, well, how can we leave now and have this thing go bad fast? And if it goes bad, how do we know that won't happen? Well, the Democrats came back and they said, wait a minute, we have to give this regime in Iraq an incentive to make the deals. The deals among the various groups that will keep them in power, they won't have that incentive unless we give them a time certain. Back and forth they went. But I thought the best comment of the day that I heard was from a Republican from Connecticut, Rob Simmons. He said he was for the resolution, but in a qualified way. And he brought out his experience in Vietnam. He said, you know, there comes a time when an occupying army, just by being there, becomes a negative. There's a tipping point that it alienates the population. And he said, we are very near that tipping point now, and I don't want the Iraqis to think, or anybody to think, we're going to be in there for a long time.
Jonathan Alter, Americans don't want to be cotton runners. And yet the country has watched how difficult this war has been. I think everybody's alert now to the possibility that our presence is engendering an awful lot of trouble, even as it may tamp this thing down a little bit. Do you think that emotional play will work at the polls this fall? Can we divide it back into the kind of emotional black and white? Do we cut and run, or are we good for our word?
Well, I think that's what the Republicans are going to try to do, but I don't think it's going to be successful this time. I think they've gone to the well one time too many. This is a case where the record will finally count, and the disastrously incompetent prosecution of this war, I believe, will be what this election turns on, and it'll be a referendum on do you think the Republicans have administered this war, have fought this war in a competent fashion. If you look at some of the numbers that are in the New York Times this morning on the op-ed page.
This is from Michael O'Hanlon and others.
Yeah, Friday's New York Times. You know, in May of 2003, 3,000 insurgents, Today, 20,000 insurgents. Number of foreign fighters, you know, terrorists, 100 in May of 2003. Today, 1,500. So, and the list goes on and on and on.
It's kind of the metrics of the war. Michael O'Hanlon and others saying, Michael O'Hanlon, who was pretty supportive of this war effort, who joined us this week on the air saying, I'm not so sure now, even saying we may have to let them duke it out.
Monthly incidents of sectarian violence, 5 in May 2003, 250 in May of 2006. Mm. So there are a few indications, though, that the Iraqis might be beginning to be capable of at least trying to quell some of the sectarian violence themselves. So, if, you know, for instance, you have three times as many police officers and soldiers who are at a full state of readiness, 60,000 compared to just 20,000 a year ago. So, and then you also have a lot more, and this is again from Michael O'Hanlon's chart here, you have a lot more examples of actionable intelligence tips from Iraqi civilians. And that those are the kinds of things that help them to quell the violence. And they indicate that the ordinary Iraqi, you know, is getting tired of his countrymen shooting each other, kidnapping their children, and otherwise making it impossible to lead a normal life. And you need that kind of reaction on the part of Iraqi civilians for this government to have a chance. But I think the main thing to focus on politically is not the road from here, because that's you know, trying to figure that out, I don't think anybody knows exactly what the right mix of redeployment and stay the course might be. That's not what this election should be fought on politically. It should be a referendum on the decision to go to war in the first place, and then the way they've handled the war and their disastrous decisions to disband the Iraqi army and the other miscues. It's a very mild way of putting it, disastrous mistakes that they made in the fighting of this war.
And yet there's a kind of assessment of how Americans look at politics, look at the world. Do they want to look back and judge? And there's a lot to judge on here. Or do they want to look forward? The Democrats struggling when it comes to the looking forward piece. Here's John Kerry at the same meeting that Hillary Clinton was at saying, we've got to have a hard and fast deadline for getting out.
I believe we need a hard and fast deadline, not an open-ended commitment of U.S. forces, so that we shift responsibility and demand responsibility from the Iraqis themselves.
There's John Kerry. Now, Bill McKenzie, I want you to listen carefully along with Jonathan and Jack to this next one, because the Karl Rove, George Bush, Iraq War dynamic is really interesting here. Rove cleared. He's out of the Valerie Plame gun sites this week, out of Patrick Fitzgerald's mission plan at this point, we're told, in the clear. And very quickly, up in New Hampshire, talking to the Republican State Committee there about John Kerry, about the Iraq War, you can hear the strategy that you're all describing coming right out of the Rove mind here. Let's listen.
You may have seen what he's just recently come out and said. He said he is for the complete withdrawal of American troops from Iraq by the end of the year. He's been joined by others in the Democratic Party. Congressman Murtha says he wanted the troops out by the end of April, deployed to another country in the Middle East. Now, I'm not questioning the patriotism of Senator Kerry or Congressman Murtha, but let us examine for a moment how appropriate and correct their policy recommendations are. Like too many Democrats, it strikes me they are ready to give the green light to go to war, but when it gets tough and when it gets difficult, they fall back on that party's old pattern of cutting and running.
Bill McKenzie in Dallas, you've watched Karl Rove and George Bush for a long time. Here's Rove cleared and back on the hoof. What do you make of it? Where does the Rove push go now? Is he the main strategist again? Is he hand in glove with George Bush? What do you see here, Bill?
Well, he is the main strategist. Whether he is hand in glove with Bush is a very good question, because at some point, sooner than later, Rove and Bush start to diverge. Rove is made it pretty clear he wants a permanent Republican majority. And this much we know, Bush's time ends in 2 years. And so Bush, to some extent, whether he will admit this or not, he probably won't, he is thinking about the next 2 years of his administration and, yes, his legacy. Karl Rove will never say this because George Bush is his long-term client. He doesn't want to think there's much difference between the two of them. But at some point, Karl Rove is thinking about beyond 08. And I think you can see that, you know, there could be a tension within the White House as to which way they may go.
I want to give some thought to how that may play out, but let's bring our listeners in as well. A lot have been waiting. Michael's calling from Woburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. I think the most important news story of the week was the lack of an indictment of Karl Rove because it allows the administration to use him and his tactics without or with less fear of public shame. Not that they've ever been particularly ashamed to use criminals in the past. Karl Rove is a master at framing issues such that the non-issues are more important. Things like who likes God more, who can strut around like a cock of the walk the best.
Michael, you got a rough line, but we hear it there. Not happy about Karl Rove being in the framing seat again, and yet there he sits. Jonathan Alter, Bill McKenzie is looking here and says, you know, at some point there may be a fork in the road for George and Karl, for Bush and Rove. Their interests may not be the same. It sounds to me like they're probably the same around Iraq at the moment, but might there be some light opening up there?
I don't think yet. I think eventually, yes, but for right now, they're together on this, on how to handle the midterms. And when a political figure says, I'm not attacking their patriotism, that's code for I am attacking their patriotism. So basically, this is the bare knuckles Rove strategy. This is the way Bush has always played the game. Going back to, I was down in South Carolina covering that primary in 2000, and this is the way they play. They unleash the dogs to call Max Cleland or John McCain or whoever happens to be in the crosshairs unpatriotic or somehow, you know, not sufficiently American. And then the president is able to stay above the fray and say, who, me? I didn't do this. But, you know, he's very much on board for that political strategy. It's worked very, very effectively for them. They're teeing it up again this time. And the big question of 2006 is whether it will work again or whether the Democrats can kind of untangle themselves and say, no, this is not about, you know, you challenging our patriotism. This is about your pathetically incompetent management of this war. And so they have to keep the focus on the competence issue in terms of the decision to go to war and the way the war has been handled. And if they get tangled up in what do we do next? Are we, you know, patriotic? Are we not? You know, get defensive about that. They're going to lose again. They have to keep the focus on Bush and his competence. And they've got some cards to play because the American public, if you look at the polls, they're pretty convinced that this guy's incompetent. They just have to keep the focus on that, and they'll do pretty well in the midterms.
Jack, what do you think? Americans ready to look back or ahead in this November election?
Well, I think the looking back is a risky strategy, actually, for the Democrats. I mean, I think people tend to think, well, we're there, and we have to make the best of it. And I was feeling, even though I agreed with them, as the Democrats kept going over the list of mistakes that Jonathan talked about, and I kept feeling, well, yes, but what's going to happen now? What should we do now? And I really don't think a referendum about the past is going to take them very far in this election.
Jeff's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think?
I just wanted to say I think the biggest item of the week was by far President Bush's visit to the troops in Baghdad, because, you know, this has certainly been a long campaign and it's been very trying on people's patience in terms of trying to seek some resolution. But you know what? His visit there, and I have family in the military, and
yep,
they're based out of Fayetteville, they were invigorated by his visit there. And it's just his words, which were heartfelt You know, he doesn't want them there any more than they ultimately want to be there, but he realizes why they need to be there. The troops realize it. The troops know that no matter what the Democrats are going to say, the president is behind them 120%.
And it was very dramatic to see him there. Let us ask you, Jeff, you know, the question is whether the cut-and-run critique of the Democrats is going to send reporters, voters to vote Republican this fall, or whether the sort of trouble of this war effort, fiasco some say, is going to send them into the Democrat camp. What do you think?
Well, long story short, I think that there are a lot of people on the right side of the aisle that are disillusioned by the rationale and the reasons or the lack thereof for the war. But the fact that we're there now, and the fact that you have what I perceive as some arrogance on this, so you have Nancy Pelosi talking about what she's going to do and how this, that, and the other thing. You know,
Jeff, you're breaking up on us, but I think we've got the tenor of that. Let me get another call here from Augusta, Georgia. Ken is on the line. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think the real big news story is Bush's return from Baghdad and how this physical, actually physically going there and coming back should somehow make the American people trust his analysis, which on actually every major point, from the original notion of going in and why, to the extent to which it would need to be funded, to how we would be greeted, to the stabilization of the region, the fundamental parts of his analysis and his administration analysis has been utterly wrong. And somehow he now can return back and say to the American people that I've been there, I've looked the new Iraqi regime, which is new today, will probably be different very soon. Somehow I know and you can trust me. When before the war, the guy didn't know the difference between a Shia or a Sunni.
And
you're,
that's a fact. We hear it, and you're not ready to jump on that bandwagon. Bill McKenzie, take us in here again. You're down in Bush country. Mm-hmm. You understand the conservative mind pretty well. You hear our caller from Chapel Hill saying, look, I'm impressed by the president out there rallying the troops. Both the theater of it and what he perceives as the president's heartfelt support for this effort. Then our caller from Augusta saying, come on, wrong, 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 up and down the line. I'm not going to be swayed by this theater. Where do you think conservatives are going to tip on this?
Well, I think conservatives, as well as lots of Americans, are in the position of holding two contradictory thoughts in their mind. One is, as the caller from Augusta illustrated, most of the points for which we went in the war were wrong. Most of the predictions were wrong. And it's hard to refute that. On the other hand, I think many people see, you know, we are there and pulling out perhaps would make the situation even worse unless the Iraqis who begin to show that they can govern themselves send us the signal, you know, it's really time to go. But I think that's where the American public is, that we're holding two contradictory thoughts in our mind. We think the reasons we went into the war were wrong, and no matter what Bush says about it being central to the war on terror, well, it was probably only a part of the war on terror, one central to the war on terror. But now that we're there, what do we do to perhaps try to redeem a bad situation?
So two contradictory thoughts at once, which means it's a real battle, kind of a jump ball to own it, to frame it and own it.
And I would go back to what I would argue with Jonathan that this November election will be a referendum on whether we should go to war. I think that is kind of an older point, and perhaps you could argue the 2004 election was about that. Perhaps think though that the management of the war is central to this election.
Jonathan, our caller from Augusta is right with you. He said, "How do we trust going forward if we can't trust looking backward? Can the Democrats ride that, or is it too backward looking?"
Well, no, I agree that it shouldn't be about, you know, should we have gone to war? That's in the distant past. I was more focused on the mismanagement of the war. And I think that elections are partly referenda on how a president and a party, especially if the party controls all branches of government, you know, how they've performed. And to say that they should not be judged on their record, I think let's them off the hook too much. The Democrats are not going to be in charge. You know, even if they get all of Congress, at most what it would be a check on President Bush in the next couple of years. Mm. So what voters have to think about is, do they want to continue to give President Bush and the Republicans a blank check, or do they want some kind of check on what they're doing? The Democrats don't have the power to cut and run. Even if they were to take control of both chambers of Congress. So even in the worst case scenario, in Karl Rove's most fevered imagination, we won't cut and run. It's not going to happen. The question is whether we will have a more nuanced policy, whether we'll have more accountability for performance, mm-hmm. which is what a lot of this is about to me, you know, whether moving forward we will have more of a more consultation with the other party in how to prosecute this war.
Jack Meade, what do you make of the Democrats' struggle on this? We heard earlier Hillary Clinton being cheered and booed because she didn't call for a date certain to get out. John Kerry talking about a date certain, but that hasn't gone anywhere yet. Can the Democrats put together that kind of nuanced line Jonathan's talking about that's strong enough to resist the cut-and-run pansy charge of the GOP, and yet nuanced enough to deal with what Americans, I think everyone says, rightly see as a nuanced situation?
Well, nuance can get them into trouble. I mean, it seems like weakness. It has in the past. The Republicans have successfully portrayed them in that light. You know, objectively, they have things going for them, the Democrats. 23% of Americans have a high opinion of Congress, 23%. By 49 to 38, people say they would rather have the Democrats than the Republicans. The 60% of Democrats have a very high level of interest in the fall election compared to 52% of Republicans. Even among Americans, according to the Wall Street Journal, with over $75,000 a year, uneasy about the economy, a third of them. So, you could say there's a lot of reasons the Democrats can look forward. But, this comes down to 15 seats. And when you start to really look at them, I mean, is Rob Simmons in Connecticut, he's one of the people I mentioned earlier, a Republican, is he going to be vulnerable? I don't know. Chris Shays, is he going to be thrown out of Greenwich, Connecticut because his opponent says we have to get out of the war now? I just don't know about that. I don't know whether that's going to work at all. I think people in Greenwich, as Bill said, as elsewhere, they have these contradictory ideas. This was screwed up, but we're there now, and how does leaving right now help? And I think that's I really think that the Democrats had better talk about other things in this election. Or they could more profitably than about leaving Iraq now. And, you know, really, when you come down to that, that's all about 2008 politics. That's John Kerry trying to give Hillary make a hard vote for Hillary Clinton. And base politics is great in primaries, but it's not really what works among in general elections.
Mm. Let's turn to
Jack. I think Jack raised an important point that we're only talking about a handful of swing seats in the House, that is. So we aren't talking about a national election necessarily. We're talking about how this plays in certain districts, not necessarily all across the country.
Let's turn to Mark in Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Thanks for doing it.
You bet.
Hey, it's a potpourri, but I'm going to pick Karl Rove for this week.
Okay.
He is the spin of sin, as far as I'm concerned. I frankly don't remember him being on the voting card.
But he was sure standing big right behind it. What do you think of his return, the green card? He's out of the penalty box.
Yeah, I don't like it because, you know, I kind of attribute most of what's wrong with the Bush administration to him. He's pushing the agenda, and you know, a couple other guys, Rumsfeld knows, but I think he's the guy whispering in the president's ear. And, I'd like to see him be back on the sidelines or, you know, selling flowers or something.
That's over, Mark. He's on the field. Jonathan Alter, help us look at that for a moment. Five times before the grand jury, there was fevered speculation last fall that we could see all kinds of indictments in the White House, and Karl Rove at the top of that list. Now he's walked. Is it end of story there on the Valerie Plame CIA leak case? Is this indeed a get out of jail free forever card for Karl Rove?
We've got this kind of silly tradition in this country where if you're not indicted, that's seen as a clean bill of health. You know, politically,
that's a good start.
It basically ends it as a problem for them politically. But we shouldn't assume that this means that Karl Rove behaved honorably in this case. At a minimum, he discussed with a reporter the identity of a classified undercover CIA operative. And there's been a lot of dispute about, you know, was she really undercover? It has been established that she was. Mm-hmm. So at a minimum, he violated the terms of his security clearance. And, you know, my position throughout all of this is I never actually thought he would be indicted, but I believed in the past and still believe that he should have his security clearance lifted because he violated the terms under which it was granted. So but what happens is because most people have more important things in their own lives to worry about than the complexities of a Valerie Plame case, they just, you know, look with some good reason to what Patrick Fitzgerald concluded. And when he decided not to indict, that basically ended it. And I think we're now going to move into the post-Plame era. And even though the Scooter Libby trial is coming up and there might be some, you know, there will be some big publicity that week. I don't think that this is going to be a huge issue moving forward.
Let's get a call from AJ in Potsdam, New York. Hi, AJ, you're on the air.
Good day. I think the biggest news story of the week was the decision 5-4 in Hudson v. Michigan. And I would also posit
this is the Supreme Court on no-knock police searches.
Yes, sir.
Saying we will uphold them.
Yes, I would say I would put spotlight this and posit that was really the main thrust behind the 2000 election battle in the Supreme Court, Bush v. Gore, and the arguable fraud in that election, and some contend in 2004, was to remake the federal judiciary in the image of these so-called neoconservatives. Others might use a stronger term. I'll take my your comments off the air. Thank you.
AJ, thanks very much for your call. Bill McKenzie, how about it? The Supreme Court lines up here for no-knock police searches. Do we have a trend? Do we have the Alito court, and all the rest at work here?
Well, I think you do. As a big government conservative who also has civil libertarian leanings, the ruling kind of makes me uncomfortable. But I think you definitely see the imprint of the two Bush appointees there.
5-4 vote. The judges say you cannot throw out evidence collected by police who have search warrants but do not properly announce their arrival. Bill, do you see that as a nuance or as an important sort of gift to police there?
I see it as a latter. I see more tilting towards the law and order side of the equation rather than nuance.
Jack Meade, sorry, yes?
No, I'm just go
Jonathan.
Ahead with Jack. I just had a thought on this, but
we'll take it,
wait
Jonathan. What do you think?
I'm really glad the caller raised this because I think it's extremely important that we talk about this issue. It will probably be the most long-lasting issue of this week. And basically what they did was they gutted what's called the exclusionary rule, which has been the legal tradition in this country, upheld on countless cases, that ill-gotten fruits cannot be admitted into court. In other words, if you violate somebody's civil liberties when you're gathering evidence, mm-hmm. that evidence cannot be used in court.
Should not result in a get-out-of-jail-free card for defendants was sort of the way
it's
put. That's
right. But this idea of what they call the exclusionary rule has been a bedrock principle of civil liberties. And the Supreme Court went a long way to getting rid of the exclusionary rule in this case. They also went back on a legal common law tradition that goes back to the 13th century in England, suggesting that you need to knock and announce yourself if you're the police entering somebody's home. And in this case, by a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court said, if you don't knock and announce yourself, you still, if you get the drugs or whatever you're recovering, you still can use that in court. Now, on one level, you go, oh, well, that's common sense. If the guy's guilty, mm-hmm. you know, he should He should pay the price.
Mm-hmm.
Right, don't get off on a technicality. The problem is that those technicalities, that what sound like technicalities, are actually the only thing that sort of stand between us and the police doing whatever they want. Because if the police figure, hey, you know, we can do whatever we want to do to get evidence because it'll still be admitted in court, then that throws out all the other constitutional protections as well. And you end up really lessening our privacy and our civil liberties in this country.
The knock-and-announce rule is dead in the United States. This is David Moran, who represented Hudson. There are going to be a lot more doors knocked down. There are going to be a lot more people terrified and humiliated. Jack Beatty, we'd better keep some of this country's debates in a realm of civility here. If there are going to be doors knocked down, we better have some common understanding here.
Yeah, and you know, the argument you hear often from people, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. What do I? Boy, rights don't work that way. I mean, they're protections for all of us, not just those of us who might be guilty. You know, the Fourth Amendment is really taking it on the chin these days. It's central in this illegal, I think, eavesdropping by the federal government, and now here again. That Constitution means something, and it only is going to live if the Supreme Court and the administration honor it.
Big issues in play this week. Bill McKenzie, we didn't even get to immigration. I know that's still big in Texas. We'll have you back to talk about it. Bill, thanks very much for joining us from the Dallas Morning News.
Thank you, Tom.
Jonathan Alter at Newsweek, wonderful to have you. Thanks for your great analysis. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
And Jack Beatty, great to have you as always. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.